who we're talking to today is ex-Star Sergeant Irving Locker, who's in the US Army and came over here in the early part of 1944 and went right through Exercise Tiger, followed by the Normandy campaign, and eventually went right the way through with the armies to the end of the European War, and very nearly on to Japan as well, but was saved from that. So, Irving, if I may take you back to those fateful days of April 1944 and Exercise Tiger. Now, can you tell me which of the landing ships you were actually in? Well, you were one of the early ones, I think.
One of the early ones that we came in on that. And the Tiger exercise basically was strictly to get us to train under live ammunition, which was the first time that we've done that. Because we started with England and Ireland and Scotland, Wales, and etc. But going on the boats, off the boats, on the boats, off the, because our guns were 9.5 tons.
Yeah.
And the big thing was to get them off the wheels,
right,
because we were mobile.
So, if your ship in Exercise Tiger was fairly close to the front of the convoy, and the single escorting corvette, which we know was inadequate, did you know that an attack had taken place on the ships further aft in the convoy?
No, it was kept a total secret. Number one, they didn't want the American families to know that their boys got killed before the invasion. Number two, they didn't want to ruin our morale because basically it was strictly a tragedy and an error that all of this happened. But we were not aware at all.
And even when you arrived at Slapton Beach, where I believe the timing was wrong, can you say something about that?
No, the timing was wrong basically, and they were firing. Some of our men got killed that right on the beaches because they were supposed to fire before, but due to the time-wise, whatever it was, there was at least an hour difference, and some of our men got killed on the beaches as well. So it was a real tragedy.
That sounds so terrible.
A real tragedy.
But even then, you still didn't know that there had been two LSTs lost and one severely damaged.
No.
Not even at that stage.
Not even at that stage.
When did you first hear about the attack then?
A few years back now is when we first heard about it. And to be honest with you, the first American book that came out with it came out this past month.
Gosh.
Talking about the Tiger exercise tragedy, and that's what they called it.
It was,
and the first thing that they did was talk about that same basic thing.
Absolutely.
Because other than that, we were not aware whatsoever.
Yes. We have subsequently learned that even those who were not drowned, those who were injured, went into hospitals along the south coast, in Dorset and so on. There was a complete shutdown of those hospitals, including the doctors couldn't go home, nobody. But anyway, moving on from there, after the exercises of April and May, presumably, we then get to the real thing.
Right.
And I believe you left from Exmouth.
Exmouth.
In an LST with your guns.
Yes.
Well, can you tell me anything about that journey from Exmouth across to the Normandy beaches?
Yes. The biggest thing that I can tell you is we were so seasick that the men really were. I personally had to stay on deck. I could not go below deck at all because whatever the heat or hit me. But we were on deck and we were so seasick that even transferring from the LSTs to the Higgins boats, we were sick. We were totally sick with it. And that's the honest thing that I can talk about.
But once you got there.
Once we got there, then it's a different ballgame. And what people don't know is we have a history of it to the point that on June 6th, D-Day, the American force has landed 23,250 men on Utah Beach, 34,250 men on Omaha Beach, and they ran 15,500 airborne troops in the British sector The British had sent 24,970 men to Gold Beach, 21,400 to Juno Beach, 7,900 to British and Canadian airborne troops to do, and the Canadian troops numbered 28,845 on Sword Beach. 177 free French soldiers were with the invaders that landed.
So that's something over 100,000 troops. Were landed in the first day.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So they lost, on D-Day, the Allied Air Force flew 14,674 sorties, and 127 of them were lost.
Mm. Mm.
So it's interesting on those things.
It was a huge event.
Yeah, a huge event.
But when you, you were with an anti-aircraft artillery, that's AAA battery. Can you tell me how you landed, or when you landed and were able to deploy your guns?
Yes, first of all.
And something about the guns, of course.
Something about the guns, basically. But first of all, the seas were so rough and so choppy that we missed our total entry point. And if anybody has seen any of the movies of Roosevelt, they missed it by 2, 3, 4, 5 miles. And when
was Roosevelt? Sorry.
Roosevelt was the commander of, he was on the LSD. He was one of the commanders.
I see. Related to the president?
Related to the nephew of the president. But he was brought in basically to lead the troops. And he wanted to be on beach because he thought it would help the morale of the men.
Mm.
He was a general.
Right.
And if he landed with them, it would help the morale.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we missed our focal point and missed a lot of the shelling, etc. Because the Utah Beach was so well fortified at that time that basically is well known. It was well mined. It was a multitude of barbed wire entanglements. It was hedge groves. It was wood points. Strong points have been set up behind the masonry wall. The existing buildings have been fortified. Fire trenches, concrete machine gun emplacements, and pillboxes have been erected at strategic points along the beach, behind the wall and the sand dune. All the roads have been fortified and mined. The gun emplacements for heavy weapons, up to and including 280 millimeter coastal defense,
which is about 11, is over 11 inches.
Right.
Yeah.
Have been placed in the hinterland for direct laying on the beach. The more you thought of it, the more convinced you were that the long life you had been promised yourself stood a fair chance of being materially shortened.
Yeah. So tell me about the guns themselves.
Okay. The guns itself were 9.5 tons each gun. And basically, it was an improvement over the German 88, where we could fire these guns, which are 9.5 tons. We could fire these guns 30,000 feet up into the air. We had the only ammunition. The ammunition that could go through the armor on a German tank.
Mm.
And whenever the infantry got stuck in any which way, we could get behind them because we were mobile. And we could shoot 6 miles over their head with it.
Yeah.
The ammunition that we handled was 3 feet tall and weighed 45 pounds each shell.
Yeah.
There were 14 men on a gun, 5 men to control to the gun controlled, and 9 men just to control the ammunition, because we could fire 20 to 25 rounds per minute.
Yeah, they're quite some weapon.
Yes.
And they were essentially dual role, so that you were both anti-aircraft, which was the official use, but actually you could use them in the anti-tank role as well.
Right, absolutely.
For which they would come right the way down.
Come right down and we could look over, the commander would look over the, let me explain it to you this way. When we fired at the planes, we had radar, which was the first time, we're talking 70, 75 years ago. We had radar, which could pick out the height of the plane, the speed of the plane, and then they would go through what we called a fuse center.
Mm-hmm.
When we fired the round up there, it would get there, they would tell us how far in front of the plane, and then because of the fuse, it would explode, and it was the shrapnel that hit the planes, not the bullet itself.
No, that's right. That's right.
So,
I'm very as a
interesting
as,
point that people
having been in the Navy, I'm very very familiar with the problem, and it's a pretty major problem.
When it came to a tank, you would look over the barrel and fire straight ahead. So you had three rounds to hit the tank. If you didn't get him in three rounds, and he turned the turret around, you're dead, totally dead, because you could not escape.
Yeah. Well, you told me earlier a little tale about counter battery fire from the Germans and how they found out where you were.
Yeah, basically, an interesting story. Everything had to be brought in to us. Everything had to be delivered to us with a truck in any which way. We were there, and one of my men was up in a tree because the communicator, we had no cell phones at the time. One of my men was up in a tree fixing a wire. Noticed that the truck came in, it raised the dust in the road because we lived in the fields. We were not in a city. So it raised the dust in the road. When the truck stopped, the dust settled. After 5 minutes of that, then we got shelled or strafed, and we couldn't figure out how the Germans knew where we were or what we were doing, basically. But it was the dust in the road. Mm. If he had not been up in that tree to discover, I wouldn't be alive today.
What were you, you were living out in the open. I mean, what were your living conditions like?
Absolutely horrendous. We had to dig a hole every night. Originally, we protected the guns with sandbags, that we had to fill sandbag to go around the guns. And then we would go into a tent. But eventually, after that, the Germans use anti-personnel bombs, which is basically a 50-gallon drum filled, hypothetically, filled with all the filings of the factories, etc. Mm-hmm. And then they put a detonator on the bottom. So when it hit the ground, it went sideways. It went through our tires. It went through our trucks. Went through our men. We could not sleep in tents. We had to dig a foxhole every single night and crawl into a hole and do it. During the Battle of the Bulge, weather was zero weather and below or above, and you lived in a hole, and that was it.
So your route took you from the Normandy beaches. You've just mentioned the Battle of the Bulge, so you were going right through into Germany, and you finally ended up in Berlin?
And no, I personally did. The fighting stopped at the Elbe River.
Okay.
And then, of course, between Roosevelt and Churchill and the dignitary, they decided that it would be the Russians who could take Berlin. However, being a staff sergeant and having the liberty of doing pretty much, I was a proclaimer. I used to go out and pick up things from my men and et cetera, from the German people. So I had a Jeep and I had privilege. Mm. And I went into Berlin, brought back a big Nazi flag with the off a wall, had my men sign it, and I tell them an interesting
great,
story.
Great memento, yeah.
I tell them a story about this cap. Interesting. I wear this cap, and a young man saw me and basically said, gee, my father was in the Army, and he went in on D-Day and went through the Battle of the Bulge as well. But I was only 18 months old when he got killed in a car crash. So I invited him to come to my house because of the memorabilia that I brought back with me. And he discovered that fact that my name, he found my name in his father's Army book. When I invited him back, his father signed that flag.
How amazing.
That I brought back from Berlin. I had a lot of my men sign it.
Yes.
And he found his father's name. And so many people find a name, their grandfather's name, their uncles, their aunts, and see that because I go.
Amazing. An army of that size, and you still
do it.
You can still do it. Now, I believe nowadays you go out and talk to schools in the States.
Yes.
Do you get plenty of interest?
Plenty of interest. Most veterans don't talk about the war because it has nothing greater in their memory. But I was invited because of the memorabilia that I brought back. I was invited to go to the schools and lecture to the children. And I'm totally amazed that kids 14, 15, 16-year-old don't know who Hitler was. And they don't know when I talk about the Holocaust. Mr. Locker, what's a Holocaust? And I happened to visit a Holocaust camp in Gardelegen, Germany. And I brought back pictures with my own camera that I take to the schools, and I lecture to the children about the Holocaust and about the war and about the different things. And all of this memorabilia, I dragged her to the school. So I continually do that till today. As a matter of fact, I was complimented by one of the congressmen in my town to the point that I'm one of the very few people who will go out and talk about this and keep it alive. And my theory basically is, lest we forget man's inhumanity to man, as well as what we went through to do it. And one more expression, when we talk to the children, if they can read a sign, they have to thank a teacher. If it's in English, they have to thank a veteran.
Yep, that's a good little lesson to learn. Well, now you've been in Dartmouth area now for about a week. Have you found people here been interested in your stories?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, at the hotel we're at, people have been sending champagne to the table for us, and they are
fantastic.
Wonderful,
fantastic.
Pleasant, and everybody, the receptivity is great.
Oh, it's incredible. But you're leaving Dartmouth tomorrow, I believe. Where are you going next, and when do you finally get back home?
We're going to Plymouth.
Portsmouth.
And then we're going to France to celebrate our June 6th celebration. And from there, we go on home, and I'll be home June 9th with a load of memories that are absolutely wonderful and marvelous.
Well, very many thanks to you, Irving. And of course to you, Bernice, for putting up with all of this, which I'm sure you've heard many times before.
Well, yeah.
But it's been brilliant seeing you here and also being able to sit down like this and have a chat.
And I thank you so much, and tell everybody we're married 65 years, we're doing very well.
That is pretty close to being a record. I believe the Queen is getting close, yeah. But not as close as that.
I was going to meet the Queen because I understand she gives you a letter if you're married
60 years. She does indeed.
And if you're married 65, she gives you another note beside.
My own parents didn't quite make it, but my in-laws just made it. Yeah.
So we're married 65 years, and I'm looking forward to that.
Brilliant. Well, many, many thanks.
And I thank you from the bottom of my heart, really, truly.
Really good to see you.